Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present writer and activist Kevin Alexander Gray, who examines the long history of the Republican Party's appeal to race hatred in U.S. election campaigns, seen again in the 2012 primary battle. Emily Bernhardt, an associate professor of biology at Duke University, who discusses the findings of an important new study on the effects of surface and mountaintop removal coal mining on water quality. And Josh Levy with the media reform group Free Press, who talks about the effectiveness of recent protests opposing proposed federal legislation to crack down on internet piracy. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Human Rights Watch reports the government of Ethiopia has pushed out 70,000 indigenous villagers from the western Gambela district to new enclaves that lacked basic services, adequate food supplies, and educational facilities. The report, which was based on over 100 interviews in rural Ethiopia, found that the village relocation program was not voluntary and, in fact, harmed indigenous people. The program also exacerbated hunger in the region already devastated by famine in the Horn of Africa. Jan England, European Director for Human Rights Watch, called on the Ethiopian government to suspend the village relocation program until it can ensure the infrastructure is in place and that people have been properly consulted and compensated for the loss of land. The relocation program is taking place in areas where significant land investment is planned or occurring. The Ethiopian government has consistently denied that the resettlement of people in Gambela is connected to the leasing of large areas of land for commercial agriculture, but villagers have been told by government officials that this is an underlying reason for their displacement. Former local government officials confirmed these allegations to Human Rights Watch. 42% of the land in Gambela has now been leased to foreign investors from Saudi Arabia and China. The residents of Gambela, mostly indigenous Anuak and Nuer, never had title to the land in their villages. Over the next 3 years, the government plans to resettle 1.3 million people to new communities. Global investment in clean energy hit a record $260 billion in 2011, fueled in part by stimulus spending on renewable energy projects by the Obama administration. But the stimulus funds have now been spent, and U.S. investment in clean energy is in decline. Globally, investment in solar energy grew by 36% to $137 billion in 2011. However, investment in wind power fell by 17% to $75 billion due to a market glut of wind turbines and solar panels driven by low-cost Chinese manufacturers. While China has won praise for its investment in solar energy technology, the emerging economic powerhouse still gets over two-thirds of its electricity from dirty coal plants, a chief culprit in generating greenhouse gases linked to global warming. For the first time, China's energy planners recently called for a limit on the burning of coal, but there is fear that a proposed cap will be ignored by provincial officials seeking to increase economic growth after a recent slowdown in China's normally booming economy. A USA Today investigation reveals major design flaws and enormous cost overruns in the toxic cleanup at the massive Hanford Nuclear Reservation owned by the U.S. Department of Energy that was closed in 1989. The site has 177 underground tanks of radioactive waste that date back to early nuclear weapons tests during World War II. The current remediation strategy relies on a plan to build giant treatment buildings to contain and stabilize 56 million gallons of radioactive waste. In recent weeks, on-site engineers have complained of design and safety flaws, raising the prospect of a possible hydrogen or nuclear explosion. At the moment, there are three active federal reviews of the Hanford cleanup program involving the Department of Energy and its prime contractor, Bechtel. In November, the Department of Energy's Oversight Office notified Bechtel it was looking into potential nuclear safety noncompliance issues, both in the design and installation of plant systems. The size of the cleanup at Hanford is unprecedented in terms of the volume of waste and the unusual mix of toxic and radioactive materials, and there is no clear technical fix in sight. Congress has expressed frustration with the program's constant cost overruns and major difficulties with contractors, which led Congress to cut $100 million from Hanford's annual cleanup budget. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
As candidates for the Republican Party nomination for president battle each other in primary states this year, the nation is reminded of the party's longtime history of appealing to racial hatred. Since President Johnson signed civil rights legislation 40 years ago, many politicians within the GOP have embraced racial politics to win over white voters, especially in the South, where the majority of whites have been loyal Democrats since the New Deal era of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. President Richard Nixon's exploitation of racial division to win votes in Southern states is referred to as the GOP's Southern Strategy. With this November's presidential election, where Barack Obama, America's first black president, will be campaigning for re-election, issues of race are never too far below the surface. On the primary campaign trail, Newt Gingrich charged that Obama is America's greatest food stamp president in history, and also urged that 9-year-old inner-city youth be hired as janitors to clean toilets, instilling the work ethic they lack. Rick Santorum attempted to cover up a highly charged statement where he declared, "I don't want to make black people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money." Candidate Ron Paul's history of racist rhetoric can be read in his newsletters, in which one article made this observation about the 1992 Los Angeles riots. He said order was only restored in L.A. when it came time for the blacks to pick up their welfare checks. The Republican Party's greatest contemporary hero, Ronald Reagan, very consciously launched his 1980 national campaign for the presidency in Philadelphia, Mississippi, the town where civil rights workers, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, were murdered in 1964 by members of the Ku Klux Klan and the local sheriff's office. At the campaign stop in 1980, Reagan advocated the restoration of states' rights, interpreted by many in the South as advocating a return to pre-civil rights laws that banned segregation. Your reporter spoke with writer, activist, and South Carolina native Kevin Alexander Gray, who examines the long history of the Republican Party's appeal to race hatred in U.S. election campaigns and the just-concluded GOP primary election in South Carolina.
This isn't new for South Carolina. A lot of it is how, you know, the history of South Carolina and the Confederacy, being the state to fire the first shot in the Civil War, Strom Thurmond and the Dixiecrats separating from the Democratic Party to become the modern Republican Party that we know it, the Southern Strategy that using race that was first coined, that phrase was first coined during the Nixon administration, and the architect of that was a fellow by the name of Harry Dent, who was the head of the RNC at the time. And then, of course, his protege was Lee Atwater, who went to work with George Bush. Lee also worked with Strom Thurmond. Lee Atwater was the head of the RNC. And then, of course, you know, you remember Willie Horton, but Willie Horton, which was raised, the issue of Willie Horton and who he was raised by Al Gore, but Willie Horton's from South Carolina. And then you come forward to, you know, Karl Rove, who is now the present-day architect of that kind of divide-and-conquer Southern strategy politics. So it is not new. And, you know, you look at Gingrich and you talk about Gingrich talking about food stamps and the food stamp president and Santorum talking about black people taking something out of white folks' pockets. But it's not like all the racism in America is confined within the borders of South Carolina. The folk ought not get that impression, because the country is profoundly racist. It is still a profoundly racist country. It's just that the racism in South Carolina, because of South Carolina's history, is so obvious.
In 2011, we had the issue of economic inequality rise to the top of the heap in many ways by the activism of the Occupy Wall Street groups across the country.
Right.
And of course, in this Republican primary season, we see a lot of appeals to racial bigotry. In terms of race and class in this 2012 election, you see them both sort of major issues with America's first black president trying to win re-election, or you think these issues of racial bigotry are going to be subsumed, eclipsed by the issues of class when we have so much wealth going to the top and so little to the middle and the lower classes?
Well, I mean, politics is about addition and subtraction. You figure race and ethnicity is, and difference, being different from the white male patriarchal mindset. That's the Republican stock and trade. You know, when they're talking about taking back America, they're talking about taking it back from everybody else that doesn't follow that mindset or that model. So that remains important. Of course, when you're talking about white and playing race, you're saying to whites who are maybe economically impoverished or struggling or whatever, working class, that, hey, you got something beyond them. You got your whiteness. And that's always going to be what folk play. Obviously, the issue is about class. And some of the issues, everybody's getting right. It's just that they're misdefining them. You know, when you talk about crony capitalism, well, that's the definition of how Newt Gingrich came up through the system. That's about using government to benefit yourself or your friends. In many respects, it's about to the victor belongs the spoils. So we got to figure out, is that what we want as a democracy? The other thing is vulture capitalism, and that's Romney. The complaint of the working class, as regards the breakdown of the manufacturing community and base in this country. People like Romney come in, pull out everything that's good, take the business and move it overseas, put people out of work, and reap the reward. And then you've got Wall Street socialism, which is what the 99% and the Tea Party have in common. That's about giving your taxpayer dollars to banks to bail them out, and they don't lend, and they pay it off in bonuses and sit on the rest and play that in the international market. Meanwhile, unemployment is rampant, and everybody keeps losing their houses. So, you know, there's nobody unifying that kind of economic analysis to say that all three of those are the argument that the 99% have against the 1%, and a change for the redistribution of government resources, and then the money we put in war. I mean, that basically protects the crony and the vulture capitalist. So it's all tied together.
How do you think the media has treated the whole issue of race in this Republican primary in South Carolina and the other states? We've seen the campaign where these same issues have been brought up. We had Juan Williams, of course, bring it up, and Newt Gingrich slammed him.
It was a setup. You know, it was a setup the same way that asking that question about marriage was a setup. And then, of course, that set up with Juan Williams, that was the Newt Gingrich's ad that was up the next morning and running all across the state. So it was a setup. But nobody really talks about race in a historical context. Everybody keeps talking about, well, that's old time. Or they just don't pick up a book and read and understand their history. They deal in the now instead of in context. We can't depend on the mainstream media to provide consciousness and do that kind of education, because their job is profit, too. They're not really concerned that Citizens United is overturned. They're making the money with all this money that's flown into politics.
That was writer and activist Kevin Alexander Gray, author of The Decline of Black Politics, From Malcolm X to Barack Obama. Find a link to Kevin Gray's articles on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In December, an article appeared in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that exposes the impact of surface and mountaintop removal coal mining on water quality downstream of mining sites. The study reveals that the problem persists many years after reclamation, indicating current environmental protection strategies are not addressing the problem. The findings show a clear connection between the amount of mining in a watershed area and the impact on water quality downstream. The study, titled Cumulative Impacts of Mountaintop Mining on an Appalachian Watershed, conducted by Duke University at the Hobet Mine Complex in southern West Virginia, was the first to measure water quality both upstream and downstream of mining discharge outlets. One crucial measurement was more than 8 times higher than the standard set by the Environmental Protection Agency. The findings confirm what opponents of mountaintop removal mining have been saying for years, that these destructive mining methods are responsible for contaminating surface waters in many communities. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Emily Bernhardt, an associate professor of biology at Duke University and co-author of the study. She explains how the research was conducted, what it reveals, and the next steps to better understanding the impacts of surface mining on water quality.
What is really important about this recently published study is that we show in a large watershed with a tremendous amount of surface mining, we show a very clear relationship between the absolute amount of mining and the level of water quality impact downstream. So we took samples upstream of the Hobet Mine Complex and then through the Mud River as it flowed through the Hobet Mine Complex, basically with 8 new tributaries contributing additional mining runoff into the stream. And we see this very consistent, very strong relationship between the amount of mining being drained and a large number of trace elements and metals and salts in the Mud River itself.
Is it killing aquatic life or causing deformities? Can you say more about that?
The two components to my answer to that question. The first is about fish. So selenium, which is an important contaminant in alkaline mine drainage, is highly elevated in the Mud River system, and it has been clearly associated with a very high incidence of fish deformities in the Mud River Reservoir, which is about 10 kilometers downstream of the last mining-impacted tributary of the Mud River. And so there's clearly an effect on fish communities in this system. We did not measure the effects on insects in the Mud River itself, but in other work we're doing, looking regionally at stream insect communities, and stream insects make up the base of the food web in all of these systems. In regional analysis done by our group here at Duke, but also by the US EPA, we see a strong decline in the number of sensitive species of aquatic insects in streams once conductivity goes above 300 microsiemens. What does that mean? It just means that these very sensitive freshwater organisms cannot handle very much salinity at all, and they disappear from the system.
Emily Bernhardt, has this kind of study ever been done before, where you go upstream and downstream of mining discharge outlets and measure the differences, or is this a first?
It's a little bit remarkable that this is actually a first, because what I think is so powerful about this study is it's very simple. Just going to a large mine complex where a river happens to be moving through the mine complex and looking at how its chemistry changes as you move downstream.
Critics might point out that you haven't shown there's any adverse impact on humans, so what's the big deal?
There's two different reasons that we should care. One is that we often use stream insect diversity or composition as an indicator of water quality, and we use them as sort of the canaries in the coal mine. When we lose these sensitive mayflies and stoneflies and caddisflies that are really a dominant part of the communities of these Appalachian streams, we think, oh, we should be worried. There's something in that water that's not right, that's not the way that it used to be. And that may or may not lead to important human health consequences. So that's part of it. The other part of it is that we have laws to protect species living in aquatic ecosystems in this country, and we are supposed to be protecting species that are sensitive within aquatic ecosystems. And so even from just a pure legal sense, we have a responsibility to make sure that we're not losing sensitive species.
I thought it was interesting where your study says that individual permitting decisions are made without consideration of the extent of historic mining impacts, because there's other environmental problems where if you take each permit application individually, it may seem fine, but when you add them all together, it's disastrous.
The thing with surface coal mining in this region is that each mine is directly putting waste rock and coal fragments into stream valleys. So they're putting waste directly into the river system. And every time you do that, you're contributing new pollutants. And every single mine is then adding to the background pollution load that's come from every mine in the past within that watershed. And so if we continue to permit new mines without considering all of the mines that have already occurred within a river system, then we're going to keep increasing the contaminant load and increasing the distance downstream that water quality impact can be seen. And we really do need to change the way we're thinking about this and consider the cumulative impacts. And I think the Mud River is a great example of that.
What's next for your team or for other scientists maybe working in this field?
I mean, I think the biggest open question is how do we remediate these impacts? Even if coal mining were to stop tomorrow, and it's not going to do that, but even if we were, we still have impacts that are occurring even decades after mining ceases on an old surface mine. And so how can we actually go back and remediate those mines in a way that we protect the downstream water quality? And I think that's really where we need to see a lot of research dollars invested.
That was Duke University biology professor Emily Bernhardt. For more information on the issue of coal mining and the effects on water quality, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With the backing of Hollywood movie studios, book publishers, and the music industry, the U.S. Senate's proposed Protect IP Act and House legislation dubbed the Stop Online Piracy Act looked like they were headed for easy passage. But the legislation designed to prevent the piracy of U.S. movies, music, and software confronted an effective grassroots campaign that viewed the legislation as a mortal threat to creativity, innovation, and freedom of expression on the Internet. Some of the largest internet companies like Google, Twitter, Reddit, and Facebook agreed and aided in the effort to defeat the piracy laws. Opponents maintain that the legislation is overbroad and would force search engine companies to act as censors on behalf of the holders of digital property rights, severely restricting freedom on the internet. Widespread online and street protests organized at the grassroots to oppose the piracy bills were launched on January 18th, and exceeded expectations when more than 115,000 websites participated by either going dark or featuring protest signs on their homepages. The protests generated an estimated 3 million emails and thousands of calls made to members of Congress expressing opposition to the bills. Not long after the protests began, many legislators who had previously supported the anti-piracy measures reversed course and announced opposition to the bills, or support for a delay in scheduled votes. Your reporter spoke with Josh Levy, Internet Campaign Director with the media reform group Free Press, who talks about what's at stake for Internet freedom in the current fight over anti-piracy legislation.
These two bills, the Stop Online Piracy Act in the House and the Protect IP Act in the Senate, they're both basically the same versions of the bill, were designed in order to help deal with online piracy, the practice of sharing and copying copyrighted goods without permission. And while we think that the rights of content creators absolutely need to be respected, we and many, many others had a big issue with these bills because they went too far in trying to deal with this problem and would have actually broken the Internet as we know it. And the open Internet, this Internet that we depend on to communicate with each other and that we expect to be able to access the content that we want and to communicate in the ways that we want and to say the things that we want. A lot of those things that we take for granted would have come under fire if these bills had gone through. So we stood up and we opposed them and we said, let's set aside the fact that we need to respect the right of content creators and take a look at what these bills actually accomplish. And what they would do is enable Internet service providers to erase URLs, the domain names of a site, so that it would not be able to be found on a site like Google, for example. It would be able to sever the relationship between these websites that are accused of piracy and other sites like PayPal, for example, or advertising networks, so that the income that would be coming into the accused sites would be cut off and they wouldn't be able to function anymore. Those and other provisions went so far that they would actually harm probably innocent sites, and they would create a chilling effect in which big corporations that hold copyright, like Disney, for example, could clamp down on any website that they accuse of infringing on that copyright, and people would feel less inclined to innovate, less inclined to create the new business models that we've known to occur on the open Internet, and all in the service of an old business model, which is grasping at straws and desperately trying to not enter the 21st century.
When you examine the effectiveness of the online and street protests that convinced many legislators on Capitol Hill to abandon these anti-piracy bills, maybe you could dissect a little bit about why these protests were so effective.
More than 10 million people sent letters to Congress in a day last Wednesday. And this was largely because of the efforts of folks like Wikipedia, which completely blacked out. So everybody who visited Wikipedia got a blacked out page that said Stop SOPA and TIPA. But also Google, which didn't black out, but it included a big bar across its logo. And when you clicked on that, you would get information about how to take action to stop these bills. And then in addition to them, thousands of other sites blacked out, included links to take action. Advocacy groups like Free Press and Our Friends sent out emails and had people either call Congress or take action by sending letters to Congress. You know, I had friends who would say, what effect does Wikipedia blacking out really have? You know, what would this do? And the answer was that it creates an enormous amount of attention for this work. And on that day, you could not escape media coverage of the fact that Wikipedia was blacking out and the fact it was blacking out for a reason. And naturally, people wanted to know more about those bills. So you take all that and then you look at Congress, which people need to understand is always deathly afraid of this kind of attention because it means that it needs to get off its butt and make a decision about something. And you had a lot of senators who hadn't necessarily taken a stand on the Protect IP Act who were forced to say something. And then you also had senators who had previously come out as supporters for that bill and realized that the tide had turned and the public was overwhelmingly against that bill and that it was in their own self-interest to change their position and to come out against that bill. So what you saw is kind of what takes place every day in Washington, except that it's usually lopsided in the other direction. You have senators who make decisions based on big corporations' interests because that's all they hear. Day in and day out, because of the lobbying power of those corporations, senators and members of the House are hearing why certain legislation needs to go through to improve the business interests of big oil or big media or other big concentrated interests, and they rarely hear the voices of regular people. So on this day, it was impossible to ignore the voices of ordinary people, and they realized that there was real opposition here, and it was okay, it was safe to come out against these bills. So I think it was incredibly heartening to realize that they actually listened.
That was Josh Levy, Internet Campaign Director with the media reform group Free Press. Learn more about the effect of piracy laws on Internet freedom by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.